Hi, it's Redbeard in the studio on the 30th anniversary of Queen's Innuendo album with my guest, guitarist Brian May and drummer Roger Taylor. Innuendo was Queen's 14th studio album, released the first week of February 1991, but it was highly significant for a number of reasons. First, Innuendo was the first Queen album on their new American Disney-owned label, Hollywood Records. Innuendo would herald the release of the entire Queen back catalog on compact disc in America for the first time as well, filling a gaping hole for U.S. music consumers. At the time of this interview, February 2, 1991, only the members of Queen and their manager Jim Beach knew that singer Freddie Mercury had recorded the preceding album, The Miracle, and this new one, Innuendo, while suffering from acquired immunity deficiency syndrome, AIDS. I remained unaware at the time, but none of us knew then that by November, Freddie Mercury would be gone forever. We started with Queen drummer Roger Taylor's thumbnail review of the preceding album, The Miracle, followed by Brian May in the studio.
My assessment of that, on looking back, I find it a little too eclectic, I think. And I think it's a good, quite a
but
good...
But I play eclectic guitar anyway.
Eclectic, yeah. It's a little bit too varied. I think it tries to cover a bit too much ground. And because of that, it lacks a single direction. You know, it lacks an overall atmosphere and direction, which is what I think this, the new album, Innuendo, has. It has a certain atmosphere of its own, I think, and it has a little more depth than The Miracle for me.
Yeah, fair comment, I think, really. I think this is a better album. I think it's... there's more playing on this album, isn't there?
Yeah.
A lot of it came out of just the four of us playing in the studio, and it's captured... I've found myself saying, I think I said this to you already, that the fact that we're not on tour might even have benefited our studio work, because that's our major outlet for playing now. So we get really excited in the studio and the tape's rolling, and it's the only time we get to play together. So a lot of that stuff sounds very live, I think.
Yeah, and it's more of a return to, in a way, to the old sort of atmosphere of what we were about in the early days, I think, as well. You know. It's quite heavy, it's a lot of rock and roll on there, you know.
While the sun hangs in the sky and the desert has set, while the waves crash in the sea and meet the land,
through the sorrow, all through our splendor,
Don't take offense at my innuendo.
Song to Queen's February 1991 album Innuendo. I remarked to Queen guitarist Brian May that when he and I had talked in 1990, there was no innuendo in his comments. Brian was clearly frustrated with the way Queen's career had been managed specifically in the all-important U.S. marketplace throughout the entire 80s, even after their worldwide Live Aid televised performance in 1985.
Yeah, well, we were definitely frustrated about this country. It's very hard because it was the place where we felt like we grew up and became a band. And there was a point where we just had it all there, and then it gradually trickled away. So it was very frustrating for us here, yeah. It's been great in the rest of the world, but there's always that feeling that you lost the home base, if that's the right expression to use. It was very hard. So, yeah, we were major frustrated at that time. And I don't think it's even fair to blame the record company. I mean, it didn't work out well, but I don't think it's anybody's fault. It was just the wrong time and the wrong things happened. I think they legitimately tried, but it just didn't happen. We came close with I Want It All, which was... Yeah. Yeah, I think it was a good album. And in fact, it sold more in the world than the previous album did. The previous album was Kind of Magic, and that sold, we thought, as a result of intensive touring. That's what we thought at the time, you know, because we did very large gigs most places for that album, but The Miracle sold more just on the strength of what was on the record, I think, which was very pleasing. But not in this country, no. We didn't get to that point. But it's no use crying over spilt milk. It's just, I think we all knew that it's swings and roundabouts. You can't win them all. You can't be everything to everyone all the time, you know. So it's not like we got too upset. We just thought, right, we have to do something about it. We always, for some reason, you know, we always come out of albums throwing things away, and we always think, well, maybe that'll go on the next album, but it never does. We always start fresh, because you cut somewhere, you don't want to go into the old drawers and pull out the old stuff, you know. No, we started from scratch with Innuendo, just playing in the studio. We booked 3 weeks in Montreux in Switzerland, which is our sort of home studio in a way. It's very easy to do stuff there because we own it, and our engineer we've worked with for years went in the studio, and Innuendo was one of the first kind of riffs that we came up with just through playing the four of us together, and it felt very good, and we thought, well, actually this is happening, you know. And we also liked each other a lot, and it hasn't always been that way, you know, like in any relationship you go through hard times, but the hard times that we've been going through recently have been mainly personal and outside the group. So the group has been like a haven, and I think it's the best family we have, really, without wishing to be too schmaltzy about it. You know, it's felt very good to be part of the group, and sometimes it's the only thing that keeps your head off the floor, you know. So it was very good to be in there playing, and we realised that the magic was kind of flowing fine, if you can call it that. And we've all done stuff outside and produced other albums, played on other people's albums, etc. But the four of us do have a way of interacting with each other which works very well, I think. So we started off with that, and before we knew where we had backing tracks for a few songs, and we worked on them. And we normally work like 3 weeks and then take 3 or 4 weeks off and then another 3 weeks, so we never get too pressured. And it was nice, particularly with a song like Innuendo, which gained in complexity as time went on. We were never too close to it that we didn't understand what we were doing. You know, sometimes that can happen if you're in the studio with your head down. But what happened was we would do it for a while, take the cassettes away, live with them in the car, and just gradually we developed this feeling for what the song should be like in the end. So it's very painless, very enjoyable album to make. Very easy in a way.
I think it's the sort of the pivot of the album, really. It's the... You said the word pivotal, I'll use it again. I think it's the sort of fulcrum of the album for me, you know? Sort of seemed to be what it's all about, you know?
It's got that very nice sound of us actually playing together. It's funny, yeah. There's no substitute for it. In this place in Switzerland, we have... we use the downstairs room, which is actually a part of the casino. It's a concert hall. So we set up in there and we actually play together as if we were in a concert hall. And it has a sound which you can't get anywhere else, you know, by overdubbing or whatever. You know, I don't know if it's the leakage, the way the drums get onto the guitar or the other way around, but it does have a particular sound. It's lovely. It has great breadth and...
Yeah, and it's very natural sound. It's sort of organic.
And this is the same facility that was... For the
Smoke on the Water? No.
Because they were...
Exactly. What happened was the old casino was made of wood, and Deep Purple were, and I think Frank Zappa just played in the casino, and Deep Purple were recording with a mobile unit. And their equipment was there, and the casino burned down to the ground. It's a very old building, beautiful old building, and that was the Smoke on the Water. And the casino that is now there, which our studio is a part of, is what they built in its place.
Which is a monstrous looking building.
Yeah.
It's a shame, really.
Yes, it's a
pretty... But it works very well for us. It sounds good.
Right on the edge of Lake Geneva.
It's these Chet Atkins electric Spanish guitar things. That's what we used. And it was me and Steve Howe, because Steve Howe just happened to drop in. And I, being smart, realised that he could play that stuff much better than I can, because he's great at these fast sort of chromatic runs and things. So we did, you know, we played a bit together. Yes, yeah, he was recording in Geneva, I think, and just bowled in. He's a very nice guy, very relaxed. When we were growing up at school, they used to buy these sets of guitar strings, and they were never loose enough. You could never bend the strings enough, because we wanted to get into all that. So what everyone used to do was buy banjo strings and... tie knots in them so they would go on the guitar for the top couple of strings. So, but, I mean, I wasn't alone in that, you know, but certainly I wanted to be able to bend the strings enough to be able to play anything on one fret if necessary, you know, because that's the, to me, that was when the guitar became interesting as an instrument, when you could make it sing, because like a violin, you had an infinite variety of notes, not just the fretted notes. That's why that's why guitar's able to talk, in my opinion, you know, and Clapton was beginning to do that, and Hendrix, of course. And in our quiet way, we were too, but we were at school, you know. But we thought we were great, you know.
Yeah. But you did also did quite a lot of stuff in detuning to D.
That's the only tuning I use, apart from the regular one, tuning the bottom string down to D, which is on headlong.
And you're rushing headlong, you got a new goal. And you're rushing headlong, out of control. And you think you're so strong, but there ain't no stopping, and there's nothing you can do about it. You think you're so strong, but there ain't no stopping, no, there's nothing.
And also, I think a lot of people have said, you know, we haven't toured for a long time, which is true, and so do you lose the live feel? Strangely enough, I think it's almost helped the studio situation, because some tracks get developed in the studio and you have in the back of your mind that once it's out on the road, it's going to change anyway. So you put it down in a very studio form. It might be very perfect, but it can be rather clinical, you know. Recently for us, the studio has been the outlet for our playing, you know. So we've gone much more for capturing excitement of playing in the studio. So all those takes, most of those songs you hear on the album would be the first one or two takes after we actually knew what the song was about, you know. So the excitement is there. And feels good. See, going back, if I think of a song like It's Late, it was hard to play that, and we only just about learnt it and put it down, and we were much more concerned with the construction of the song, getting all the overdubs right, you know. And looking back on it, I think it was much better when we played it live, because it had the feel, you know. So now we're very aware of that. We're much more aware of what our craft is, you know. And you have to live with this stuff for years afterwards, and I certainly want to hear performances where you feel like the people are enjoying themselves. That's a big part of it. So although, you know, a lot of those studio tracks became great stuff on stage, but these days I think we have a better knack of distilling it onto the record. You know, I think Headlong sounds much fresher than any of the old stuff we used to do, just because of the technique of getting it out onto the record without any impedance in the way, you know. Part of that's the guitar, though, strangely enough. It just has that sound. Part of it's the amplifier, because I use these old Vox tube amplifiers, which are unlike the normal sort of amplifier that you get here.
Yeah.
It's a Class A amplifier. It distorts very smoothly, so it has that cutting edge, but it doesn't kind of fart, you know.
So doesn't
part
tear.
Of it's that, yeah. And part of it's the way that I grew up playing for something. I was always in groups where I had to be the lead guitarist and rhythm guitarist at the same time, so there's always that going on. I'm always sort of trying to get it as fat as possible, consistent with getting some melody in there. I got so emotional on the Miracle that I could hardly play at all, to be truthful. It's a miracle that the guitar got on that album, because I was in a mess, you know, and it was very hard. The funny thing is, as you begin to come out of the real bad spots, that's when I think things start to flow again. You know, people say you can only write when you're in pain. I don't find that. I find that if you're really in pain, you can't do anything. You can, never mind write, you can't get up, you know. But when you begin to climb out of that crater, that's when the juices start to flow, and you can start to focus your ideas and speak your feelings in a way that makes sense to other people. So on this album, I felt really good most of the time. I felt very in control, and I wanted the emotion to come through. Yeah, I wanted some of that stuff that had been stored up, messing me up all that time, to come out. That's always been one of my dreams, to play pure liquid, you know. I just, to me, the sound of the guitar is so important. I think that gets lost. You know, there's a lot of technique around. There's some wonderful players around. But to me, the sound, it's a very simple thing. But if the sound of the guitar isn't right, then I can't enjoy it, no matter how wonderfully it's played.
I would agree entirely, actually. I think Brian especially excelled himself on The Miracle and also on this album. But I think Freddie has improved again. And that might be having something to do with giving up cigarettes.
No.
He just stopped smoking, but there's definitely a sort of...
Also, he has improved. He's improved his range and everything.
Yeah, his range and his control has improved. And I think there's a new depth and sort of maturity to the performance. Yeah.
You and me, we are destined. You love me to spend the rest of our lives with each other, the rest of our days like two lovers forever.
Thank you.
separate.
I have to admit a debt here, because our hero is Jeff Beck, you know. And hearing a couple of things that he's done recently reminds you that you ought to be adventurous. And, you know, and also, I mean, he takes the time to make every note count and be beautiful, you know. So that's an inspiration. I would put that down on paper or on tape or whatever.
Yeah, we had that Jeff Beck Guitar Shop album.
Yeah.
And that really has some extraordinary guitar on it.
Lovely. Yeah.
And that was that was a sort of bit of a jumping off point, really, wasn't it? We were listening to that. I don't know what I'd put it down to. I think we just realised that's probably what we do best, and that we have strung together, and that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, you know. And I think, you know, that's overrides any sort of ego considerations. And you know, I think it's quite important to stick together, and we've done that. You know, I'm surprised that more bands haven't stuck together.
Well, I was about to say, basic, you
know,
questions.
We've had our ups and downs. You know, obviously you do, and I think any sort of creative partnership is going to have ups and downs and difficult moments. But you have to either swallow your pride sometimes or give a bit here and there to make it work, and that's just part of being a group, I suppose.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, that's right. It helps to recognise that each person in the partnership needs to have an equal voice as well. Very important. You know, in many groups, perhaps one or two of the guys will have the creative power to submerge the other two, but that's not happened with us. We all write, and we all have very strong feelings about how everything should be done. So we've recognised that, I think, and given each other a bit of space. And we also made this decision on The Miracle and for this album to credit every track to the four of us, as opposed to individual writers. And that's
going to be crazy trying to prepare this interview. So I have to ask you every time, who wrote that?
Well, the answer is that we did actually write loads of stuff together. You know, I think every track had the full force of our critical and creative abilities on it, and it's improved it beyond belief. I think it's really a help to do that.
But obviously, certain tracks were inspired mainly by one person initially. You know. Definitely. So it'd be interesting to hear your guess, and then we'll tell you the answer.
Yeah.
You may think that I don't care, but I traveled a long road to get a hold of my sorrow. Tried to catch a dream, but nothing's what I see. Love is saying, baby, it's alright, when deep inside you're really petrified. Love turns to hater on this escalator. With you, yeah, but I can live without you. I can breathe if you stay, but I can burn you to go away. I don't know what time it is. All I know is I can't live with you. We're stuck in a bad place. We're trapped in a rat race, and we can't escape. Maybe there's been some mistake. We try to make a high score. We're walking through a closed door, and nobody's winning. We're just sinning against ourselves. Hold on, baby, tell me it's alright. Anger's breaking from the hurt inside. Passion screaming high. We'll be right back.
It's a strange song. It almost doesn't let itself breathe, does it? I know, there's so much in there. It had a strange history, that song, because I did the demo on my own when I was in Montreux, and I played it to the others, and they liked it. And we developed it as we normally do. We get in there and start replacing things and making it a proper group thing. But the arrangement was more or less laid down. But it was hard to get it to sound like the rest of the stuff on the album, because it's one of those things where if you put all the faders up, it sounds reasonably okay, and you think, okay, we can mix it now. But as soon as you start making choices and taking out some of the demo material, it sort of fell to pieces. So it was quite hard to mix for some reason.
I think you got it.
Well, maybe. There was some doubt, though, as to whether... I mean, it certainly doesn't sound... like the sound of the drums isn't as broad as some of the other stuff on the album, but it's just a different kind of animal for some reason.
We had a couple of versions of it actually, and they were both quite different. You know,
yeah, strange song. I listening to it the other day, I was wondering if I tried to put too much vocal in it. Really, in a way, the vocal became the main thing, because I think it's one of Freddie's best vocal performances on the album. It's incredible, particularly the bit he puts in at the end, which is completely gratuitous. You know, he made another song at the end. So the vocal is wonderful on that, you know. But there isn't any breathing space at all. The vocal always answers itself, and there's hardly a gap in it, is there? Strange song.
With Queen's storied Live Aid performance a little more than 5 years in the rearview mirror, I asked Brian May and Roger Taylor its significance. Roger goes first.
And, you know, the feeling of that it was a global event and it was actually doing some good. You know, it was an incredible day.
Incredible, yeah.
But something that Bob Geldof should everlastingly be very proud of, I think. I think we'd had, in fact, an incredibly successful few years in Europe, and quite a lot of the rest of the world, with the exception of America, where I think we were probably at our lowest ebb at that point. And just before Live Aid, I think we'd come off a very successful album, as I'm saying, elsewhere, and we'd done quite an exhausting tour. And I think we were a little bit jaded. And I think what it served to do was revitalize and reawaken our interest. Because it was a wonderful day. It was a wonderful thing to be a part of, you know.
Fantastic, yeah.
And the fact that we went down very well, you know, it was sort of icing on that. But it was a wonderful day, in that, we thought.
It was great, yeah. It was also nice for us to realise that we could do it without the usual accoutrements, you know, because we didn't go on with the big light show or our own sound system or most of even our own stage gear. We just went on there the same as everyone else did.
Just walked on with the instruments. And so it was comforting to know. No check or anything, you know.
Yeah, so it was comforting to know that we didn't need the props. We could do it just the four of us. It was a very good feeling.
It renewed our confidence, our self-confidence, really, I think. Yeah. And sort of got us back in the studio again, whereas I think we were contemplating sort of a year or two off, you know.
Yeah. It was nice to get that reaction out of a crowd which wasn't our own audience as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We were used to getting everybody reacting in a particular way because, you know, they'd bought the tickets to see us, but in this case it wasn't so. It was a general admission thing and people had come to see the whole thing, but they still did this amazing thing, particularly with Radio Gaga doing the hand claps all in sync and everything, you know, wow. Which was a first for anything, I think. And it showed that they must all have seen the video, otherwise they wouldn't have known what to do.
Yeah. And the whole stadium was just singing along, and it was a great feeling, and the atmosphere was quite electric.
Background noise, a backdrop for the girls and boys who just
doesn't really make that much difference, I don't think. You know, the fact that they own the studio, it's just that it's always there when we want to fly out to Switzerland and use it. And we know it's a good room. We know how to use that studio well. You know, we know the room. Mm. And David Richards, our co-producer, knows the room and the equipment there backwards. And so it's nice in that respect. But apart from that, there's no other real game.
No other difference. No. Just the speed, I suppose. It's just very convenient.
Yeah.
And Dave has his fingers on the buttons. And if you want to try something different, it's done before you've even finished asking.
There's no waiting around.
Yeah, that does help. I must say, it makes the creativity flow without problem. I just had that problem, actually. I just produced a track, actually in Metropolis, but not with the people that we normally use. And they were very good engineers, but they didn't know exactly where everything was. So everything took twice as long. Yeah. So it is very nice to have a familiar situation.
Yeah. There's one other thing with Mountain Studios which does it, which is a benefit again, now I come to think of it, is we've got a tremendous instrument stockpile there. We have a tremendous wide range of instruments, you know. Like we've got every... Exactly. There's every conceivable percussion instrument, you know, that you can imagine, a full set of timpani, and it's all right on hand, you know, and there's all kinds of keyboards and pianos and even cymbals and stuff like that. So, you know, it has a tremendous...
If you're searching hard for something, don't try so hard. If you're feeling kind of nothing, don't try so hard. When your problems seem like mountains, feel the need to find some answers. You can leave it for another day. Don't try so hard. But if you fall and take a tumble, it won't be far. If you fail, you mustn't grumble. Thank your lucky stars. Savor every mouthful and treasure every moment. When the storms are raging round you, stay right where you are. Polish all your shiny buttons, press a slam instead of button. But you never had to try to stand out from the crowd.
Try so hard.
Yes, it's an extraordinary high in the, that key. It's, I don't know how he sings that so high. In fact, when he'd done the vocal, I don't think he did it. He was quite surprised.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Incredibly high notes in there.
I would never have thought that and, that was even close to
it. It's amazing.
I find that a very sad song, and I find it, it gives me shivers down the spine a little by the second verse, but it's quite a moving song, I think.
It is.
I like that one. Yeah.
Great.
I think also, actually, it wasn't just that. I think it's also up here and a sort of discipline to his singing. And also, he sang everything in the control room.
That's true. That's an innovation.
Which is it's totally unheard of, you know, virtually unheard of.
That's right, yeah.
And in fact, we did all the vocals, virtually all the vocals of this album were done in the control room, which was always considered hardly possible, let alone...
Desirable.
So with no ear, no cans, no earphones, you know.
No phone.
No, just
that's
using
right.
the speakers.
Nope.
No vocal booth, straight, just at the right in the control room in front of the speakers, in front of the desk.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's right.
No, it's odd, isn't it? We've taken to doing it as a matter of course now.
Yeah.
It's nice because it's so easy to communicate while you're doing it. You don't have to start pressing buttons to talk to each other. You're there. And pitching is nice as well. You're not, because sometimes that's a bit of a problem in the headphones.
Yeah.
But if you're in the room and it's all around you, it's natural.
What a silly goose.
When the outside temperature rises, and the meaning is all so clear. 1001 yellow daffodils begin to dance in front of you, oh dear. Are they trying to tell you something? You're missing that one final screw. You're simply not in the pink, my dear. To be honest, you haven't got a clue. I'm going slightly mad. I'm going slightly mad. It finally happened. It finally happened. Whoa, whoa. It finally happened. I'm slightly mad.
Oh dear.
I'm one card short of a full deck. I'm not quite the shilling. One wave short of a shipwreck. I'm not my usual top billing. I'm coming down with a fever. I'm really out to sea. This kettle is boiling over. I think I'm a banana tree.
Oh dear.
I'm going slightly mad. I'm going slightly mad. It finally happened, happened. Finally happened. Finally happened. I'm slightly mad. Knitting with only one needle, unraveling fast, it's true. I'm driving only three wheels these days. But my dear, how about you? I'm going slightly mad. I'm going slightly mad. It finally happened. It finally happened. finally happened. Oh yes, it finally happened. I'm slightly mad, just very slightly mad. And there you have it.
I think I'm a banana tree. It's made me laugh every time for months, actually. It
still makes me laugh. The bit that makes me laugh, strangely enough, is when he goes, oh dear.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what gets me, oh dear.
It's knitting with only one needle and not quite the shilling.
Actually, that is a very unusual term in for us as well. Yeah. It's very Noel Coward, isn't it? You know, it's like,
Well, it was exactly that. It's I started off doing one all the way through, and then it seemed to need a bit more schizophrenia building into it, really. So I played lots of other different kinds of sounding guitar, and we had it in the room next door and everything, just to make it sound like you didn't know where it's coming from. And a couple of things are unison, double tracked, you know, but just some funny sounds. That's all. It just sounds. It's meant to make you laugh, really.
But actually, that's strange. The first time I heard Brian play ever, I remember, I was very particularly impressed with the sort of touch and tone, which was a sort of had a musicality I hadn't heard before. Mm-hmm. It's touch is part of the sort of tone, isn't it? It's a sort of vibrato thing. It's very, very musical, very melodic style of playing Brian Hess, I think.
It's funny that my recollection is the same of Roger, really. First seeing him tune up his snare. I've never seen anybody tune a drum before. The drummers I knew just sort of played it the way it came from the shop, I think. So Roger was doing these very very musical rolls on the snare, you know, just before he touched anything else. And I remember thinking, that's, you know, I hadn't heard that kind of thing before. And it's strange, we both have the same memories of that. Yes, I think as a band, we're very aware of sound. You know, you can make great, wonderful records, you know, and build in all sorts of arrangements and everything. But if it doesn't sound nice, nobody wants to listen to it. I think it's something which isn't talked about very much these days. You know, the sound quality is vital.
Sometimes I get to feeling I was back in the old days, long ago. When we were kids, when we were young, things seemed so perfect, you know. The days were endless, we were crazy, we were young. The sun was always shining, we just lived for fun. Sometimes it seems like lately, I just don't know. The rest of my life's been just a show. Those were back and go.
find no change.
That's right. I mean,
that's right. I don't think so.
Yeah, normally we get tended to make it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 part, but I'm a big fan of 2-part. Actually, I love 2-part harmony, and I think it works very well on the choruses. Yeah.
Nice. We actually did try a few things, didn't we?
We tried several ways.
This is mainly Roger's song. You probably guessed, because Roger wrote the lyrics, which I think are excellent. Actually, I would say.
Oh, thank you.
But no, it's very good. But that's right. We tried a few things, and the 2-part. Has the most movement, and if you put the extra part in, it can't have that movement.
It blends it out. These are the days. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. It's quite nice because it starts off incredibly sparse and bare and almost hardly playing, which I like a lot.
Yeah, I like that.
And then it just sort of develops into this sort of waterfall of notes, which is nice. Very nice, actually.
Have to pull something out, because Roger gave me these chords which are impossible to play over. Spent a long time scratching the head.
I also gave you the idea of I had made a demo of it, and I played it to Brian and Freddie. I said, look, you don't understand, it's going to be really sparse, you know. Mm. And I played in this demo, and I think it had 2 notes in the entire solo, and they were just sort of... and that was it, you know. And Fred nearly fell off his chair, I think. He said, yes, I've heard of sparse, but that's ridiculous. But I thought Brian turned it into... There's some very nice phrases at the end as well.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Well, I know we could play this album very easily. I think it would translate very well to the live stage, but it's a difficult one, that, because I mean, we never know what's going to happen next. I think 3 of us would probably like to tour, but I don't think the other one would.
So, at the moment, Freddie's not keen on touring.
Yeah,
and to be fair, touring is harder for him than it is for the rest of us. Because of he has to keep himself in such close shape, you know, and he's fanatical about always being in shape to give the optimum performance, and he has to take care of himself a lot to do that. You know, he doesn't go out and drink and smoke or party or whatever. He keeps himself in trim, so it's not as much fun for him on tour as it is for us. It's hard work for him. So at the moment, he doesn't want to, does he, really?
No, not really. But, I mean, you never know. And especially if the album is...
It may change, yeah.
If it's very well accepted and it's very successful, you know, that might be a real incentive, you know. Yeah. No, not specifically. I mean, he would certainly love to regain it.
Well,
I know that. Yeah. But, I don't think so.
I don't think that's...
Because he won't tour in Europe either.
it's much more his feelings about him.
Yeah.
Did he answer your question?
I don't know.
because I get the impression that you were still playing South America. So
No. We haven't played live in 5 years.
That's right,
The last thing we did was an enormous tour of Europe, and I think Freddie felt it was such a high. He said, well, let's stop on that. That was incredible. And also he felt that, I mean, as we are all getting older, he, as the lead singer out the front there, he really didn't want to become what he feels, I think, probably oversensitively, is like a parody of himself. And he certainly didn't want to go wearing ridiculous outfits anymore, you know. And I think he'd looked at a few of his peers and thought, I don't want to do that. I do not want to look like that. You know, it smacks of desperation, and I want to keep my dignity, I think, you know.
Until he can do it in his own way,
yeah,
it's probably wise to, until he feels comfortable with where he's at.
Yeah, I think he wants to be, you know, they remember him as a tremendous showman, you know.
Very often when you write a song, there's a lot of different stuff that you could be talking about, and it all blends into one after a while. So it's not too specific. I do like that song, Show Must Go On. And I saw it as very Freddie and sort of wrote it around the way, partly the way I saw him and the band and sort of personal things. So there's a lot in there, really. But mainly I just like the sound of it. It's another one of those things, you know. I find it's one of those things you can wallow in. It's very big and it's like great big landscapes in it. I enjoy that kind of thing. A lot of people would call it overblown crap. But I think that's what we do best.
It's sort of lush.
Empty spaces, what are we living for? Abandoned places, I guess we know the score. On and on, does anybody know what we are looking for? Another hero, another mindless crime behind the curtain in the pantomime. Hold the line. Does anybody want to take it anymore?
The Show Must Go On, from Queen's February 1991 album Innuendo, the last with the one and only Freddie Mercury, who died in November that year. I'm Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Brian May and Roger Taylor. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2021, all rights reserved. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter. For more exclusive classic rock interviews, live performances, and free stuff, visit inthestudio.net.